I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. This conversation is with the brain scientist George Lakoff at Berkeley. George, we associate you and we owe you for a lot of cutting-edge work over the years on this very big idea that the rational mind is embedded not just in the body, but in habits and history and frames and metaphors that are not exactly logical, not at all abstract, not simply fact-based, and sometimes not even rational. And you're famous now for applying the big idea to American politics and the 08 presidential choice. I've got three questions, George, I want to put to you about the campaign as of mid-July, but maybe I should just ask you to begin with your own account of what it is you're up to, among other things in your new book on the political mind, why you can't understand 21st century American politics with an 18th century brain. Take us into the Lakoff view.
Well, Chris, first, it's really wonderful to be back on your show.
Thank you.
Now, the basic idea is this. In the last 30 years or so, a huge amount has been discovered about the brain and the mind, and very few people know about those discoveries. Yet they change utterly our understanding of what it is to have human reason. And they also have immense political implications. So we grew up with essentially a view of the mind that came out of the Enlightenment. It was a very important view of the mind. It said we all think the same way. That's why we can govern ourselves, a very important thing. And it assumed that the mind worked like this, that all reason was conscious, that reason could just fit the world directly as it is, that it was logical. So if you knew the facts, you would reason to the right conclusion, that reason was dispassionate, that emotion got in the way of reason, that reason was mainly there to serve the purpose of self-interest, and that reason was disembodied and abstract, that it wasn't a physical thing. We now know that all of these are false, and that knowledge changes a great deal. But this is not out in public, and what this book is doing is giving a popular introduction to what those discoveries, at the same time pointing out why they're politically important.
It's so getting out there, George, if I may say, in books like Dan Ariely's Predictably Irrational and this Rise of Behavioral Economics, and your own work that so many brain choices are rooted in places that we don't even know.
It's true. But there is a big difference. The question is, what is rationality? And there's this old view of rationality that I think is just false, that the new view shows what real rationality is, and that the idea that people are just irrational and we just have to know the irrationalities and watch out for them, I think, is not exactly right. So that, I think, is a very important difference in these treatments. But you're right. Behavioral economics is extremely important. Let's start with consciousness. Turns out 98% of our thought is unconscious. It's what our brain is doing when we're busy being conscious. Let's go to abstractness. Is thought abstract? No, it's physical. You think with your brain. You have no choice, and the brain is set up to run a body. So you're thinking with a brain that evolved to run bodies. And the question is, how do we do that and what's the effect of it? And the effect is very considerable. It's not trivial that we think with our brains because the brain is not a general purpose calculating machine or reasoning device. The brain has very special forms of neural computation. We now have a very good idea about how that neural computation works, and it's not at all like a digital computer or a logic machine or anything like that. In addition, it turns out we need emotion in order to be rational. If you have a stroke and you can no longer feel any emotions, you got a problem. You don't become super rational like Mr. Spock on Star Trek or something. What happens instead is that you would not know what to want. Imagine if you couldn't feel emotions, if like or not like wouldn't matter, how would you know whether you'd like it or not? Because you don't know. How would you know whether someone else would like you or hate you for it? You wouldn't know because you don't understand emotions and you don't feel them. So what would happen is that you wouldn't be able to make decisions, and that's what happens. Turns out you can't live rationally without emotion. And the reason for this is that emotion plays a central role in our social life, our communal life, our political life, and in how we even understand who we are. So, for example, we have two main pathways for emotions in our brain, positive and negative pathways. Those are connected neurally to other parts of the brain that have to do with semantics. So, for example, very simple case, a hero-villain story. The villain does something horrible to a victim. There's emotion. You feel angry. The hero encounters the villain. You don't know who's going to win. You feel anxious, perhaps fearful. The hero wins. You feel happy, satisfied. Right? It turns out that that plot structure has emotion and content built in together, inseparable. Now, it's not just hero-villain story. It's rags-to-riches stories. It's glass-ceiling stories. It's all kinds of cultural narratives that we have both semantic content and emotional content inseparable together, because you have integrated circuits in your brain. Now, that's crucial for understanding politics, because political biographies are based on this. Think of McCain's hero biography, or the glass ceiling biography of Hillary Clinton, or the campaign biography of Barack Obama, the improbable candidate, a kind of version of rags to riches. What you have here is an understanding of politics always in terms of these cultural narratives, and you understand yourself, your own life. What do you want out of life? What are you trying to avoid in life? How do you judge other people? Same thing. So it's not the case that our reason just fits the world as it is. It fits the world through cultural narratives, through frames, through metaphors, and all of those things.
George, could I just say, and that's a wonderful summary, but you've been arguing for years that the Republicans were onto, intuitively and with study, onto a new understanding of the brain, in the framing of stories, the presentation of issues, while the Democrats were sort of tied up in their own hyper-rational, wonky political lists and agendas. What happened this year? I mean, let's get to my questions very specifically about Obama. What was what prevailed in the rise of Obama, and what sort of dilemma do you see him in now?
Okay. Let's give you the background. The Republicans have used their expertise in marketing to market their ideas. And they've set up institutions, $4 billion worth of think tanks and training institutions and so on over the last 30 years, and media institutions and so on, to get their ideas out there. They have marketed their big ideas, their general ideas about security and the market itself and the government and taxes and so on. Their ideas are out there, and they're physical. All ideas are physical, so they have physically changed people's brains. Now, that isn't underhanded or anything like that. You use language. Anytime you hear anything, your brain is activated.
What do you mean, though, that the Republicans have changed our brains? Give an example.
Well, take the idea of that government just takes money, that taxation is government taking money out of your pocket. Or that national security is a military issue, and purely a military issue, or primarily a military issue. I mean, those are ideas that they've gotten out there. The idea that we have a war on terror going on, that the conflict in Iraq has been protecting America, that's an idea they've gotten out there. And it's been said over and over and over. Now they have things that say the surge has worked. Mm-hmm. That's another idea they've gotten out there. And what's happened is that progressives have not used the same kind of techniques to get them out there because they're seen to be illegitimate. Now, there are illegitimate uses of framing. There are illegitimate uses of propaganda and so on. And there are legitimate ones, namely getting your real ideas out there, telling people the truth. But what's happened is this. The Democrats still think in terms of the 18th century brain. That is, they still think that that their thought and rationality is all conscious, that it's literal, it fits the world directly, that it's logical, all they have to do is give people the facts, they'll reason to the right conclusion, and so on. That's why they get taken by the conservatives all the time.
It's kind of a picture of John Kerry or Michael Dukakis, shall we say.
Right. Now, Obama has been a lot better on this, but he still does not have the Republicans' machinery. They have all those think tanks, all those training institutes that have been going for 40 years, all that media construction and so on. He has to do it without all of that, and he's done a remarkable job. He is, very sophisticated about framing issues, as is his writing team.
Give an example of what he's framed. Change we can believe in. I mean, is that a framing triumph?
Well, it's not merely a framing triumph because notice what that does. He has understood something that Kerry and Gore and Hillary Clinton didn't understand, namely why Reagan won. Reagan won for a very interesting reason. He understood that people voted not on the basis of positions on programs and policies and policy wonk kind of things, but rather on five things. Namely, they won on the basis of values. Reagan talked about values. If he mentioned an issue, it was to illustrate a value. He won on communication and connection with people. He convinced people that he said exactly what he meant, that he was authentic, that therefore they could trust him if he said something, that they knew what he meant by it and what he was going to do, and they could identify with him. Mm-hmm. And those were the bases on which Reagan's campaigns were run, not the issues. And, when Reagan, quote, won debates, he won them not on the basis of arguing the issues better, but on those bases. Obama and McCain have both understood this. Hillary Clinton didn't. Hillary Clinton was still, pushing the policies and the programs. And it wasn't that Obama didn't have policies and programs. He has, hundreds of experts as well. But he understood that you have to run on those bases, and he did. In addition, there's another very important thing that Obama intuitively got. And this is something neuroscience has discovered mechanistically. In 1996, the discovery of mirror neurons in Parma was a great discovery. What was discovered was we have neurons in our brain that fire when we either perform an action or see someone else perform the same action. And these neurons are connected to our emotional regions, which allow us to look at someone who is experiencing joy physically and feel their joy, or see someone writhing in pain and feel their pain. Hmm. That's what allows us to connect emotionally with other people. It's called empathy. And Obama talks about empathy all the time and uses it tells his stories all based on empathy. And he also argues that this country was based on people caring about one another, on empathy. Mm-hmm. It's a very important idea backed up by Lynn Hunt's historical research. Now, that idea is central in Obama, but it's also central in the way Obama holds his body. Hmm. If you look at Obama's body, do you feel tense? No.
you feel envious, don't. Right?
Yeah, you feel loose and lax and self-assured, right? Mm-hmm. Because the mirror neurons allow you to feel in your body what you're seeing in his.
Is that the power of the smile?
It's the smile. It's the looseness of the body. It's the holding himself erect. And there's metaphorical content in that. You know, moral is up. He's holding his head upright. The future is ahead. He's looking ahead, up and forward. It's a metaphorical body, and it's one that you feel. If you look at John McCain's body, he is tense all the time. He's sticking his chest out, and his body is all tensed. And so you feel tense. I mean, people would rather feel relaxed and self-assured than tense.
He's also wounded in the cause of his country. What does that do to our brain?
Well, it says that the man is moral because there's some – you get moral credit for self-sacrifice. There's part of there's a metaphor system for what's called moral accounting. And in there, self-sacrifice gives you moral credit. Hmm. Yeah, so he starts out with some moral credit. That's the sort of thing it does. Mm-hmm. It also goes along with this sense of values. So it implicitly says that McCain's values are the wartime Vietnam values, that he showed, which were loyalty, patriotism, and strength.
Hmm.
Those were his values, supposedly. And then you have other values that he's trying to get across, that he's a straight talker, a maverick, he thinks for himself, and so on. That he's running on those things more than any particular issue. The issues are there to show his patriotism, loyalty, strength, stick-to-itiveness, and so on.
Hmm. George, you said almost that Obama, including the body language and the way his mind works and his understanding of other people's minds, is sort of the answer to the question you've been grappling with for maybe 10 years in terms of the application of brain science to politics. Is that overstating it? And if so, if he is the kind of walking, talking breakthrough, just spell it out exactly what he's done.
Well, he's done a lot. I don't think he's the walking, talking breakthrough completely, but probably a good 90% of it. He's very, very smart and very, very perceptive and very deep. And I think the depth is what eludes a lot of people. I've read through the Audacity of Hope book in a seminar I teach. The first time we did it, it took us 3 hours to get through the first 8 pages. It was so rich.
Hmm.
If you really look at it, it's a very rich document. And he's a quite a deep thinker. What he understands is, that empathy is at the heart not only of progressive politics, empathy and responsible action based on that empathy. I think he understands that that's what our government is about. When he was asked by Anderson Cooper what patriotism was, he said patriotism begins with people caring about each other. That's why we have the founding ideals that we have, like fairness and equality. And what does that say about government? It says that government has two roles, the role of protection and empowerment of citizens. Protection is not just military protection, though it is that, and police protection, but it's also, in addition, worker protection, consumer protection, environmental protection, should be health care. And empowerment is not just schools and good education, but also, building roads and infrastructure and communication systems and an energy system and a banking system that works, a stock market system that works, a court system to not only adjudicate contracts, but that works in criminal courts and cases. Those notions of protection and empowerment, no one in business in this country can earn a dime. If you can't get bank loans and have your contracts upheld and so on, what are you going to do? And the point is that taxes are what you pay to live in this country, not in another country. Now, Obama hasn't gotten that idea out there yet. I think I hope it's coming.
Well, let me just ask, though, George, how do you account for the Republicans' success with giving off a very, very different signal that the government's in your way, that you're probably better off on your own, that we're not here to take the money out of your pocket, as you say? Why has that worked almost like a spell for the last 25 years, 30 years?
was repeated over and over and over again, and the Democrats never repeated their ideas over and over again.
Hmm.
They got it out on talk radio. They got it out in every political discussion. They set up their think tanks. They spent $4 billion on the think tanks. They trained tens of thousands of Republican spokesmen to say it over and over again. And what happens in people's brains is when you hear a word that expresses an idea, that you every idea is in the form of a frame. That frame is physical. There's a neural circuit for it. That neural circuit is strengthened every time you hear a word that's defined in a frame and that's in a system of frames. The whole system of frames becomes stronger and stronger and stronger in your brain. That's why they've gotten those ideas out in political discourse.
The neurons they fire together wire together eventually.
You got it. And what's happened is that the Democrats have still thinking in terms of the 18th century brain, still think that it's somehow illegitimate to frame things out in public. That somehow framing can, the assumption is if reason just fits the world in itself and if language is directly fitting the world, then choosing language that frames things in terms of your values is manipulating people somehow. It's not manipulating people. It's honestly saying what you think. Now, you can use framing to manipulate people, but framing is the most normal thing you do. Because every word is defined with respect to some frame. Anytime you talk, you are framing constantly. So framing in itself is neither good nor bad. It can be used fraudulently by frauds. It can be used honestly by honest people. Now, Obama, you asked about Obama and the centrism issue.
Yeah, important. He's got the nomination virtually in hand, and he's under all the habitual pressures to go to the center, as they say. And he's embraced faith-based social services. He's talking about immunity for the phone companies in the wiretapping questions. He's doing a lot of things that rattle people. What's going on?
First, I don't know what's going on. There are at least three or four possibilities. And I don't want to choose him, but I think one should begin by taking him at his word. He said, no, he's not moving to the center. Now, of course, that's like saying, don't think of an elephant. But the idea here is he says he's fundamentally progressive. And he said that. I hadn't seen him even use the word progressive before because he has been talking not about progressive values but about American values. But what's interesting here is that the claim coming out of the campaign is that he hasn't changed his positions in any way. He has, quote, refined them. That is, this is a nuanced issue. And I think there's a problem that has to do with how people will understand him. Even, people like Bob Herbert, strong supporters, have seen him as, as adopting conservative positions when he claims he's not. On the question of immunity, I don't know why he voted exactly as he did. Presumably, there are two reasons that have been given by others, and I don't know his. The reasons given by others is that this bill is much better than the alternative that one would have in the other bill. And the second is that although there is immunity from lawsuits, there's no immunity from criminal prosecution. All right. And so this I don't know. I simply have no idea why he would vote one way rather than the other to get a better, a less bad bill. I have no idea.
Okay.
He has talked about being pragmatic, however, and that's important. In his book, The Audacity of Hope, he says it's important to be pragmatic, to understand when you can win and when you can't and what you have to do.
And what works.
And what works. And so the question there is this a question of pragmatism, of getting the best that you can, or not? I simply don't know the answer to this. On the question of faith-based stuff, I think the use of the term faith-based is a mistake for progressives. It obviously is something that that people who are in the church community, in the certainly in the evangelical community, like the term, and you know, they're going to react for it. Now, remember that Obama is a religious Christian, and that he has worked with evangelicals before in a very interesting way. Obama understands that there are two different kinds of bipartisanship. There's one kind of bipartisanship where you move to the right and you adopt a conservative view. There's another where you understand that a people who call themselves conservatives often have lots of progressive views and that you can work with them on that basis. So when he went to visit Rick Warren's megachurch, Warren is a religious conservative and an evangelical who happens also to believe that we should be good stewards of the environment, that we should care about the AIDS in Africa, that we should care about health and have good health care plans, that we should help the poor, and so on. So given that, Obama goes to Rick Warren's megachurch, and that's what he talks about. He talks about the issues where he agrees and gets a standing ovation. And what he's doing now is setting up a thing called Project Joshua for the campaign to recruit people who are in such churches and in young people in seminaries who have those views, who agree with progressives on all kinds of issues, and to get them voting for Obama on the basis of what they agree with. That's smart politics. And it's also idealistic politics. What it says is that you can unite the country on the basis of progressive values that have everything to do with the ideals of our democracy.
Meantime, all those immunity issues, even the faith-based issues, pale before this test, it seems to me, he's under about swatting Iran. Everybody knows Bush and Cheney would love to do it. There are all sorts of rumors that either the U.S. or Israel will strike Iran, maybe this fall, maybe even after the election. And there are House and Senate resolutions that would recommend effectively blockading Iran in the meantime, especially the delivery of refined petroleum to Iran. All sorts of warlike gestures that come to Barack Obama as sort of, is you or ain't you? I want you to get into his head, but also into ours as we watch this man under enormous pressure to change his own pledge to talk first, his pattern on the Iraq war, and his profile as a conciliator, not a divider. What's he going to do here?
I think he's going to do exactly what he has said in the past. He's been very clear about Iran. He wants to negotiate and discuss, not necessarily negotiate, begin open discussions, but that there are certain initial positions that he's going to stick to. One is is Israel as having a right to exist. Another is no nuclear weapons for Iran. Those are the initial conditions that he's going to put. If he talks to the leaders in Iran, and by the way, Ahmadinejad is not the most powerful person in Iran. He may choose to talk to other people in Iran, and that would be interesting. The religious leaders of Iran, before he talks to Ahmadinejad. So the real question here is how he's going to take his position that all of these things should be done through diplomacy, not through military action. Now, there's a further thing. There was a point at which Bush had said that with respect to Iran, all options are on the table, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. And then Hillary said the same thing. And then at first, Barack said the same thing. But at one point, I remember him saying, being asked about nuclear weapons, and he said, well, of course not nuclear weapons, but aside from that, all options are on the table. Well, that actually is a big deal for the following reason. The major nuclear facility in Iran is Natanz. Natanz has been hardened with 23 feet of reinforced concrete. Our bunker busters, which the Israelis also have, cannot penetrate 23 feet of reinforced concrete. Now, and even if the Israelis then said, well, what would happen if we repeatedly did it? Suppose we dropped one bunker buster and then let the dust settle, drop another and another. Would we eventually get through? And their physicists and material scientists told them, no, the opposite would be true, because you would wind up melting the concrete and it would take a physical form even stronger, that you could not use those bunker busters, even in iterative bombings, to get through. Now, the question then is, what could you do to get through? And there's only one answer to that, which is so-called tactical nuclear weapons. Well, what is a tactical nuclear weapon? Well, the smallest one we have is what's called a dial-a-bomb. That is, you can fix the amount of yield from that weapon. And the yield varies on the smallest one from a low of about one-third of a Hiroshima bomb to a high of about 10 Hiroshima bombs. Now, if you were to drop such a bomb on Natanz, what would happen is you'd get a mushroom cloud. You would also have in that cloud the nuclear materials from the Natanz facility going up into the air, as well as the materials from the bomb. The air currents would then take those nuclear materials and blow them over not only a lot of Iran, but also a lot of Central Asia, Russia, and possibly over into our hemisphere. In short, you would get, an absolute disaster. Now, our military knows this perfectly well. This is not a secret. It's there in all kinds of documentation. And there's a very good reason not to use nuclear weapons.
There's so many good reasons, George. To me, the marvel is that we're even talking about these extreme risks at a moment when whatever the risk from Iran is, there's plenty of time to talk about it. Our own intelligence findings are that they do not have an active nuclear program. And for me, the challenge or the puzzle around Barack Obama is how can he change the context, change the language, change the feeling around this whole issue? Or will he succumb to a pattern I'd also like you to explain, that it's so much easier to be a tough guy, it's so much easier to cast a war vote than to talk restraint or to talk much less peace. How does he change the conversation? How do we get away from this reflexive and scary run-up to what you say, and most of us sense would be a catastrophe in the Middle East?
Well, first, you have to understand what he's up against, and you ask the right question.
Let's talk about it.
Why is it easier? First, he's up against a mode of thought that is very common, which is what's called optimism bias in behavioral economics. That is, when you make a plan, you are more likely to think that it will work than that it won't. And, it's a very, very common bias. And then what you do is you set the bar of that optimism high, and you don't want to go below it. That there's another bias of that sort. There's a set of biases that give hawks a better chance in debate, like the surge is going to work. Similarly, or victory, it'll be a cakewalk. They'll be throwing roses in front of us.
He must have WMDs, et cetera.
Yeah, right, exactly. In addition to that, you have a way of understanding a plot structure, which is basically a hero-villain structure. Namely, the villain in this is Ahmadinejad, who is inherently evil. You've got to have these people being inherently evil, because only then can you kill them and not negotiate with them. So you've got to deal with the hero-villain structure. And there's Ahmadinejad, you know, is made sounds pretty villainous, right? And Iran is you know, showing that it's strong, and you've got it has to be a strong villain, a dangerous villain, and so on. It's a dangerous world out there, so the conservatives will say, and it is. And so the question then is, what do you do? And the answer in the hero-villain plot structure is the hero has to fight the villain. And here, we in this case are stronger. Not only that, the hero is more moral than the villain. That is, the assumption is we're moral. And anything we do to fight this villain is going to be moral. Hmm. Now, that can be utterly ridiculous, right? We could create utter catastrophe over there. But the story is what matters in the public mind, because the story says that we are a moral nation. We are a hero. The hero is going to be out there. McCain is a hero. He, you know, we need a hero leading us, you know, and so on. And then, of course, it says we're, you know, if we do that and we stick to it and we're virtuous and we are, you know, strong, we'll win. And that there's a clear difference between victory and winning and losing. And if you win, you feel happy and everything's okay at the end. And if you lose, it's horrible and you're destroyed at the end. So that narrative itself, that's a cultural narrative. It right. shows up all the time on TV shows and movies and so on, and in political campaigns. And it showed up, for example, in the first Gulf War and in the Iraq War. That narrative is being played again. So you've got to undercut that narrative. Now, that is a very tricky thing to do. And the problem, there's a main problem with it. If you try to undercut it simply with military facts, mm-hmm. you've got a problem. That is, you say, we can't fight wars on three fronts. We can't even do it on two fronts. We're losing in Afghanistan. Well, that doesn't make us look very heroic. Hmm. You know, that doesn't fit with the U.S. as the strong superpower, et cetera. You know, so you've got to fight that idea. What you need is a different idea. And what Obama has done has been very interesting so far and not commented on the media in his discussion of foreign policy. In discussing foreign policy, for example, in the American Prospect article called The Obama Doctrine, Obama's idea is not just based on national interest and on being the strongest superpower, etc., but also on the idea that we want a just world, that the most difficult problems in the world are not at the level of the state, hmm. but the level of the person. That poverty, hunger, disease, women's rights, and so on are major issues in the world, as well as global warming, and that we have to take a different view of the world. We have to be the world's greatest moral force. And I think that's the story that you're going to get from Obama. We have to be the world's great moral force again, and we have lost it. And we've lost it because we've used our military badly and because we've had bad judgment. That's the story, and the question is, will it go? Will it fly? And
in the Obama calculation, there's also multi-millions of dollars in campaign contributions here and political reputation and probably, you know, counter-pressures coming from Hillary Clinton and her friends. I mean, I wonder if, throw in the way the human brain works, if the deck isn't just hopelessly loaded against his getting a new message across.
I don't know the answer to that, but he's doing pretty well so far. I mean, it's quite remarkably well. And I simply don't know whether he'll continue to do that well.
I think
he can.
If push comes to shove on a Senate resolution, and I think it will, even this month, on swatting Iran in some fashion, what would you want him to do? I mean, would you require him to vote against it? Would you require him to address it as a as a defining issue of his candidacy, of his presidency?
Well, I think that he would have to do the following. And I don't know, so far I haven't seen him do it. Though, again, that doesn't mean he hasn't done it. You know, I have no inside information on this. He is now the leader of the Democratic Party, de facto. He should be telling Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid what to do in Congress. Now, they have their own pressures on them. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, you know, obvious pressures in the Senate and the House. But he should be saying, look, this is the bottom line for me and for the party and for the election, and it has to stop here. So he needs to be able to say, hey, any resolution has got to not allow this kind of stuff. It has to sort of, play tough with respect to negotiations or possible negotiations, but not otherwise, not in terms of military stuff. Now, blockades on Iran are just about impossible. And I think most people don't understand that. They say, oh, we have lots of ships, we just throw up a blockade. Not so simple. Iraq has hundreds, if not thousands, of small ports all along its coast. It has small boats going out all the time, many of them smuggling things in. And all you would need is one or two of those to have suicide bombers on them. They could go out and blow up parts of our fleet. You know, it's not clear that because we have a big fleet out there and they're big and strong that they would work with a blockade. You can't just simply blockade, these folks who go out there every day and know that territory like the back of their hand. I mean, it's not so simple. So the idea of a blockade needs to be pointed, and you need to point out somehow frame it as what it really is. And that's difficult, you know. The word blockade sounds like you could just block it.
Is it in his power to do it? To reframe a whack Iran resolution?
That's his job as head of the party. You know, now that he is the nominee, he needs to be able to work with the leadership in the Senate to say what that resolution is going to be. The leadership of the Senate and the House get to decide the nature of the resolution. They decide it. They decide the framing. He has to decide how that's going to be framed, and he has to make sure that Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi carry that out and that they make sure that everybody in the party knows what's at stake for them. I mean, this is where leadership starts right now.
Here's another puzzle. It's been suggested by William Kristol, for example, that George Bush would take a unilateral strike at Iran after November if Obama won. I mean, it's an audacious notion even that Bush would see a verdict against his policies in the election of Barack Obama and still use that commander-in-chief's moment in November, December to go ahead with what he and Cheney have always wanted to do anyway. How should Barack Obama speak to that, to my mind, rather outrageous possibility?
I think he shouldn't.
Really?
Yeah. I think that what you should do instead, you don't raise that possibility and say no. That's just putting that frame out there. It says Bush is still commander-in-chief and it's still his judgment and so on. What you want to do is talk about the will of the American people. That's, you know, and you've got to talk about that constantly.
Or even Congress's powers in Congress's declarations of war, acts of war.
That's right. That's what you've got to – stick to the fact that, this is a country defined by freedom, by our Constitution, and by the will of the people. And you've got to make that clear over and over again.
George Lakoff, as you said, Bob Herbert in the New York Times, Arianna Huffington, and all sorts of others are warning Barack Obama against that sort of shuffle to the middle. What's the test going to be for you, and what's the risk of blowing it?
Well, first of all, I simply don't know. I really don't. I look at what Obama has been saying, and I can see why Herbert and Arianna Huffington and the editors of the New York Times and many others who are progressive would say he's, adopting right-wing views. That is, there is a way to think about that. Now, this is a problem for Obama as a communicator. He's supposed to be a great communicator. If the people on his side think – if he thinks he's not moving to the right or moving to the center, and so many people think he is, there he's got a real problem. And that means he has to make his positions clear. For example, on Iraq, he said, when I am president, I will end this war and I will bring the troops home, period. You know, and I will do it in 16 months, period. Now, then, and I've always said that we should do it carefully, and we will, period. Hmm. I mean, that's the kind of thing he needs to say, rather than say, I'm going to go over there and talk to the generals and so on. You have to say it in the context of making your position absolutely crystal clear.
Meantime, and this is perhaps the way to sum it up, George Lakoff, what's happening to the voter's brain, to your brain, my brain, when we see this, as you say, metaphorical body, this tall, commanding, handsome figure waffling? What is that doing to our own reception?
It does bad things, and that's why he should address this right away. If he seemed to be – remember – that trust is central, that authenticity, saying what he believes, doing what he says, is absolutely central in this campaign. He cannot allow that perception to persist. He's got to deal with it as soon as possible. He can't just say, well, eventually people will come and start listening to me. He says right now, well, people haven't been listening to me. Not good enough. Because if what people are hearing and what his friends are hearing and supporters are hearing is that he's abandoning them, there's a problem, and he's got to deal with it. And it's a problem that is at the very heart of his campaign.
Can he make the point about the United States as a moral force in the world with words, or must he do something? Must he act it out?
As president, he has to act it out. It's harder to do it as a candidate. It's just simply is harder. He doesn't have that authority. And the problem as a candidate is there are these votes coming up in the Senate. What he has to do to act it out is to show that he's really leader of the Democratic Party. He has to show that he can get Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid to get the party behind him. If he doesn't have the party behind him, then there will be an embarrassment, and that will hurt all members of the party. So I think that's the next thing he's got to do. He's got to show leadership within the party.
The world wants him to be elected. Would it help for, as one pundit suggested, that he went to Europe, that he went to Moscow, for that matter, went to Iraq, went to Cairo, you name it, but to embody the excitement that a hungry world wants to feel about the United States?
I think it would help. I think the right kind of travel would help. It's got to be very carefully orchestrated. It's very difficult to carry out when Bush is in power, extremely difficult when he's being attacked. It's possible to do. I'm not sure it's necessarily the right thing or a necessary thing.
George Lakoff, this is interesting, and we want to do it again as this thing continues. You're helping us to think in a, you call it the new enlightenment way. I hope we're getting some of it.
Well, it's really important to understand that imagery matters. that how brains are affected, how even the brains of progressives are affected. And
do progressives have brains? Yes.
Yeah, we all do. And, you know, conservatives have brains. You may doubt it sometimes, but yes, they have brains. And you have to understand how people think and how brains work if you're going to figure out what's going on in politics.
George Lakoff, thank you so much. It's a joy to hear you on Open Source.
Always a pleasure to be here, Chris.